Welcome back, everybody, to the Real Connection podcast. I am Sean Santoro, mortgage agent with TMG The Mortgage Group, and I am joined by my co-host, David McCall. Dave, say hello to the folks.
Hello, everyone. Yes, the Real Connection, basically we talk about buying them, selling them, building them up, knocking them down, products, services, and if it has to do with the home, we're going to talk about it.
The whole thing, the whole gambit. And so today we are very lucky. We were joined by a good friend of mine, Nick Monteleone from Deerbrook Realty. Nick, say hello to everyone for us, please.
Hey, everybody. Nick Monteleone here. Thanks, gentlemen, for having me on the show. I'm super excited about this. It's fantastic.
You bet. You bet. Thanks for taking the time out of your day. I know things are going a little, everything's out of the frying pan into the fire right now. Things are getting heated up here for spring market. So you're probably seeing a lot on your side too, eh?
Yeah, there's been a lot of, bubbling up from the economy, which is great. A lot of things are starting to spark up. So we're happy about that. I think, a little positivity coming down the pipeline here from people. I think, buyers are starting to jump back in, keeping us busy again. So it's good. It was a little bit of a slow 2023, but, so far 2024 is doing better. And it looks like there's a much brighter future to come just around the corner. So it's great.
Now, Sean was saying that you love your data. You love the real estate market. How did you get into it? I mean, what brought you into the real estate?
Yeah. So actually, I got into real estate initially in, around 2008. I was a young lad at the time and I wasn't quite ready for the world of professionalism. I was, still figuring things out. Not to mention I had a strong interest in medicine actually. So I actually left the career, shortly after getting into it. It was about a year. I was an agent. Transitioned to a paramedic. I was actually a paramedic for 9 years until I was ready to, take the leap into the real estate world again. So I got back in and, here I am today. So, and that transition, initially from, in 2008 and then again, in 2018 was actually my parents are in real estate. So, a lifelong, history of real estate between my folks, chatting about deals around the table and meeting clients. So, I knew a lot about it before even getting into it. And it was a really easy transition for me just because I basically had lifelong training.
So. You were raised real estate. So
that's it.
Absolutely.
We're going with them on the Saturdays and Sunday afternoons. I'm sure just tagging along, doing the open houses.
That's right. So, exactly.
So Nick, the market is, It's an odd market. It's been slow for the last little bit, interest rates rising and people are holding back because, obviously they're trying to look for the best deals. But I think coming up very soon, June, maybe September, somewhere in that range, one of the two, the government's going to, ease off a little bit. When they do, what are we looking at? Are we looking at just a slow progression? Are we looking at a huge explosion into the market? And how's that going to affect the different people who are looking for homes at the various levels?
So I think there's a lot of fear within the industry, amongst the realtors, that if it goes too high too fast, we're hoping it doesn't happen because then we'll just end up back into the same position as we were, a year ago, where things were starting to go down a downward spiral. So we're hoping it doesn't. The cuts in interest rates don't ignite a big fire. However, that is absolutely a reality. I mean, we've already noticed a pretty significant uptick in buyer activity over the last few months, just in anticipation of the interest rates being cut, over the next little bit in 2024. So we'll see what happens. It's going to be a pretty interesting, evolution of the next few months. All in all, I do believe it's going to be a positive market. It's already, we already see some indicators of things going in a positive direction for especially sellers, at least, because they really took the brunt of the force over the last year just because the sales were down, pricing was down, right? So things are starting to move in a positive direction and there's already starting, the multiple offers are back again. We're starting to see a lot of that mostly now, in the entry-level market.
That's my question there. When we're talking about multiple offers, I mean, are we getting back into the, are we talking about $10,000, $20,000, bump overs and a few extra people, or are we talking about getting back to the 25 people, waiting lists with $100,000 overbids?
So I guess, obviously a lot of the overbidding is, I think a lot of people misunderstand it. And I just want to highlight that the overbidding or going above list price, it all comes down to how aggressively the listing price was initially, set at. I want to, kind of point out that homes aren't selling above fair market value. And that's an important factor for people to remember. So people are, however, listing agents and sellers are becoming more aggressive again with listing them lower and lower and lower. So we are seeing that 60, 80,000 above asking, but that's not because they're getting that much above fair market value. They're just getting more aggressive with how low they're pricing it.
They're trying to create that activity, right? They're trying to get like, ooh, 299. That's a great deal. We should go check out this house.
Exactly. It's
And
and
it's going to
causing
be
a
up at
frenzy.
325 or 350 because that's where it should have been in the first place. Well, that makes sense. That makes sense. I mean, now when it comes to the mortgage side of it, Sean, is the mortgage industry looking at the same, type of explosion? Are they worried about that? What's the concern or not concern over there?
So it kind of depends on how you're setting your clients up initially, right? And I've always been big on the education side. And so when a lot of buyers come to me and they say, I'm waiting for the interest rates to come down before I jump in. And my next question is perfect. Which ones? And their answer is like, what do you mean? I said, well, I mean, all this prime rate talk is great, but it only really reflects on variable mortgages. And I said, so if you're not built for variable mortgages, if you're looking at fixed, well, it doesn't really matter what the Bank of Canada announces, right? Realistically, right? Their prime rate changes, that doesn't do anything to fixed rates. They're set in an entirely different market. Fixed rates are built in the bond market. It has more to do with Canada in general on a grander scale, not just what the Bank of Canada wants to do relative to what the overnight lending rate is. And so that's a big thing is a lot of people think that they're connected, they're detached. They're two totally it's apples, it's not even apples and oranges, it's apples and potatoes.
That's good.
Now you're making me hungry.
It is lunchtime.
Well, now here's a question, and I always like to get different Nick, this for you, Nick. I always like to get people's thoughts on this. The younger people trying to get into the market, it's gonna be tough. I mean, you've got to come down. They got rid of the first time buyer, at least for now, the first time buyer programs.
The incentive, yeah,
Yeah, the
the first time
incentives,
home buyer incentive.
So I mean, as a first time buyer, you've got to come down with these huge, now that the prices are where they are, these huge, first time deposits. What do you see for the younger, generations? Is there anything they can do to get into the market?
Well, I mean, to get in is, I mean, they have a variety of challenges for sure, right? Like we know, I mean, first and foremost, just to qualify, you got to qualify. And Sean, correct me if I'm wrong, it's 2% above what the current rates are set at, right? So, I mean, the qualification factor in itself is difficult. Yeah, they're helping with some of the incentives with the RRSPs. They're bumping it up from, I think, 35,000 to 60,000 that you can withdraw on a new construction, a new build home. There's programs out there, so they're trying to help. But at the end of the day, I don't care. Unless there's major changes across the board, it's still going to be a challenge moving forward. And I think a lot of the damage is irreversible, unfortunately, right? I hate to be pessimistic or negative, but that we have to look at the reality of where pricing has jumped. I mean, if you look at the pricing over the last 7 years, 6 years, 8 years, it's jumped significantly over the recent time period, right? So that in itself, you can do all the programs you want unless income comes up to match what the expenses are, or the average price comes down, which would also harm a lot of people too, right? So what's the right answer? I mean, it's a really tough scenario, and it's not an easy fix. People think, oh, do this and it'll fix it. There's 30 different ways to attempt this, to solve this problem, and not always an easy, solution.
Absolutely. And so on that, now there was a lender, and I believe it was TD. They were looking to extend. So there's two ratios that you got to consider for mortgage qualification. It's your GDS and your TDS ratio. Their TDS ratio in a standard deal is 44%. So what TD was suggesting was moving theirs up from 44 to 45, which it's not crazy. It's a little more, and so it's a little bit more helpful, but that's more reflective of your total debt service situation. So it includes your car loans, credit cards, lines of credit, student lines of credit, leases, automotive leases. I just had this circumstance come up with a couple of buyers, and they were told that leases don't have an impact on your credit score. It's not considered. It's not involved in your debt servicing. If it's on that credit report, I have to include it. I can't just delete it, right? And that's the thing, is sometimes people get, you know, varying schools of advice from different avenues, and you know, it doesn't surprise me. It's really unfortunate. But now it's like, hey, listen, you know, we didn't think that this was going to be a roadblock because we didn't know it was going to be there, and now it's there. So now what do we do? And I say, listen, it's a block in the road. I can't drive through it. We can go around it, but there's going to be some things involved in doing it. So
they are trying to help a little bit. There are some things coming up. And yep. I think, Nick, this is going to help your industry because they are allowing renting now to go towards your credit rating. So that's going to help to.
Well, like the tenants.
Yes. Yep. So basically, before, if you were renting, that was it. You know, there was no, you know, no way to utilize that. Now they're changing that so that if you're renting, it actually goes to your credit rating. So if you're paying your rent on time and everything else, that's going to help your credit rating. I know I read an article that there, and you can tell me whether this is, I'm in the ballpark or not, but they're looking at home valuations going up 10% by the end of this year. Now, if that's correct, they're going to need all the help they can get, because if my, you know, $600,000 house is going to jump $60,000 by the end of this year, you know, people are going to need all the help they can get from wherever they can get it. Have you heard anything like that, or are those numbers a little high?
I think there's been a lot of, if you look at some of the reports, I know, Royal LePage puts some out, Remax. Some of them are a little conflicting. I don't know which ones would be more accurate than others. So I don't really know what to expect in regards of an increase in property value or sale price, but it would make some sense. Cause I mean, if you look at just from compared to last year, we'll talk year over year, right? So from I have the stats from January to the end of March, we're up 5% right now compared to last year. So, if that continues on an upward trend, continues without any negative influence, then, I mean, plus with the influx of buyers coming in with the drop in interest rates, that very well may be the case. I mean, we should see an increase in property, average sale price, sale property value, for sure.
Now, what about ADUs? And for those who are watching the podcast who are new to this, ADUs are basically just your small units, your tiny homes, your, you know, various additional units on a
garage
property.
Garage conversions.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And anything like that. Are you seeing more ADUs in the market? And is it if you are, is it a substantial increase or just a small one?
It's a great question. I'm glad you actually brought up ADUs. So I'm actually affiliated with a builder that's really pushing for development of ADUs. We've launched out some advertising campaigns in that regard to try and generate some attention and activity in that field, just because a lot of people don't really understand it. With that said, although it will fix a lot of people's problems, as an example, if I have a mother who's a widow and maybe doesn't have the resources or means to stay on her own, I can maybe build something for her in the backyard. That solves a lot of those scenarios that would be related to that, right? But there's also the same resistance with, you know, issues with NIMBY. Not everybody wants a NIMBY. Oh. Again, for the viewers that don't know that, not in my backyard, right? That's NIMBY. Yeah. So people argue, I don't want that in my backyard or my neighbor's backyard. I don't want all of a sudden a massive structure where somebody's also now living on the property behind me and now there's additional noise. So there is a little bit of resistance in that regard too. It really depends where the ADU is. It depends on the scenario. I think it will fix problems for some people, but I also don't think it's going to be the saving grace. Like it's going to transition, you know, the real estate market for us. I don't see it being a major factor. I think it's going to be one piece of the puzzle for sure. I think it will, you know, solve the issues for some, for a select group, but definitely not for everybody because it's not for everybody. You can't put it on every property. You know, you got to qualify. So it's a unique program.
What about the, I know Sean and I were talking about this before. What about the fourplexes? I know the city currently turned down the government money for that particular thing. Do you think we're going to see more in the way of larger structures? I know people are we have what, and I'm hoping you're the numbers guy. Maybe you can give me some accurate numbers here. I was told roughly about 8,000 people in the Windsor Essex area looking for homes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but somewhere in that. And we have an influx of people coming into this area. All across Ontario, the numbers are rising in different areas, but I'm going to speak specifically about Windsor. So with the increase in population in Windsor, with the turning down of the additional ability to build fourplexes, what do you see for the future of the home industry? I know that as interest rates go up, it makes it harder for builders because it's costing them more to build. Are we going to take a serious left turn into renting? Is that going to be, you know, your only option if you don't have the access to the cash? Or is there going to be some other options available to us?
So I definitely see a transition happening. And quite frankly, I'm for the decision that council made, that the mayor made, to withhold fourplexes anywhere. I don't believe they should be permitted to go on just any home, any block, whatever the case is. And I don't quite know, to be honest with you, I don't know all of the qualification criteria that was set out. So maybe some of the things I might be saying is inaccurate because just due to a lack of knowledge on the full scope of things. But to my knowledge, it's the same scenario as the ADUs and NIMBY, you know, objection, right? Not in my backyard. I agree with that because I wouldn't also want a fourplex next to me, knowing that we invested into this specific home for a specific reason, because it was a quieter neighborhood or whatever the case is. And all of a sudden there's three fourplexes within the immediate proximity of me. Right. However, I do believe that controlled adjustments in maybe zoning bylaws or controlled zoning changes is needed and will eventually occur. I mean, there's clear push for more housing, you know, and the council knows that, the mayor knows that. So it's not a point of, you know, is this going to happen? It's going to happen. It's just, it's going to be more of a controlled, because look at any major rapid change. Typically speaking, you're always getting a pendulum swing and it always goes too far from one way, and a quick change, all of a sudden it swings the other way and you're like, oh my God, what did we do? Why did we allow this? You know, 10 years later, 20 years later, like, what a damaged system that we created. And I think changing something too fast without really doing some due diligence and without having some restrictions is going to cause that pendulum to swing the wrong way and cause some issues for a lot of people. Again, it might solve some problems for some people right now and, you know, put out a small fire, but I think they're forgetting about, you know, not focusing just on this one battle and looking at the entire war overall, right? So there's more to look at. And I think, you know, maybe government incentives on more condo buildings, apartment buildings to be put up in the proper locations, that might help solve, you know, some of these issues. But just to throw up these fourplexes in random areas without restrictions, and I don't know if that's the answer. I mean, I feel like that's, you know, it causes some issues too.
Speaking of the top of the condo, what are, because I honestly don't know. I'm a homeowner. I most of the things I focus on are home real estate. What is the average price of a condo, and are they any more affordable than, you know, the homes? I mean, is this an option for people, or is there enough of them out there? I mean, can you talk about the condos a little bit?
Yeah, condos are a great entry level, you know, quote unquote entry level, you know, dwelling to consider, depending on the, you know, the build and all that. If you look at as an example, there's a few condo projects here in LaSalle that I'm very familiar with because I've dealt, you know, quite a few dealings with them. For the newer units that are actually going back up for resale. Because a lot of people bought into these condos when they were brand new, anticipating things were going to keep going, and it didn't. So now a lot of people are trying to unload them. I would say a lot of the asking prices hover in the mid to low $500,000 range. And that's for, you know, 1,100 square foot, two bedroom, two bathroom. Nice, very nice condo. Beautiful for sure. But so, I mean, give or take, that's what you can expect for kind of a newer unit. If they're brand new from the builder, you might even be spending upward towards $600,000. So not quite affordable anymore. But there is also resale units that maybe have been built for a couple of years or even longer. You can find some condos for $400,000, $300,000+, right? So it just depends on where it is, what it has to offer, how old it is. But for you know, we'll call it a nice newer condo, you should be able to pay give or take $450,000 to $500,000 for something that's very nice and considered new, you know, newish.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Sean.
And the condo management too, right? Another consideration. You know, who's doing the managing as well? Like we had a condo in Calgary, and we had notoriously high condo fees for years. We were just like $565 a month. That is exceptionally high relative to everybody else. However, they built themselves a very, very strong reserve fund specifically for the purposes of protecting the homeowners from things like special assessments. And anybody who's ever had a special assessment knows it sucks to get a $20,000 bill out of nowhere because, oh yeah, it turns out we need to redo all of this, you know, whatever that is. Those things come at you pretty fast and by surprise. And so having a good condo management company that builds that in there, right? It's all, is the juice worth the squeeze? You know, what are the condo fees and what do you get for it? Do they cover everything? Is it, you know, am I only having to pay electricity beyond this? Does it take care of, you know, shoveling the sidewalk and all those kinds of things? So all of that was included from that condominium board, and juice worth the squeeze, man, every single time, you know, what's it worth kind of deal.
Well, now when it comes to the, I'm going to jump back to the fourplexes for a minute. I own a corner lot property, and I mean, I would love to put a fourplex on the corner lot. You know, so you know, it doesn't. It's only affecting neighbor on one side. You know, you've got the room on the property for a fourplex. I'm confused why when the city was discussing with the government about the fourplexes, why it was such a complete shutdown, and there was no, as you said, conversation about, well, what, where can we do it, where can't we do it, where can we add it, you know, can we do this, can we just say corner lots, you know, can we say in this section of the city and not that section of the city? You know, why was, do you feel, Nick, that the conversation was just shut down completely?
Yeah, you know what? Well, first off, I think you nailed it. I think, you know, somebody like yourself, as an example, on a corner lot, you know, if the frontage and the depth of the property, if it can accommodate something like that comfortably, 1,000%. There's no issues why something like a fourplex on that property shouldn't be permitted. It's more so to do with forcing, you know, a square into a triangle hole where it's just not quite design for it, where that's where I think we would run into issues. Now, I don't know why there wasn't enough dialogue or discussion on it. I, you know, obviously we don't know half of what happens behind those closed doors. Right. You know, I'm not really sure. I don't know if there was maybe not enough given from the federal government down to you know, to the local municipal level of the details. I'm not really sure, to be quite frank. I don't know. I'm curious to see how things will unfold, because I don't believe this door is fully shut either. I think there's going to be some further development in this, and you know, and if that door is shut from the federal government, then we will create some sort of, you know, I'm sure, adjustment on our end to accommodate for some sort of progress, because it has to be. There has to be some sort of fix to this. So,
well, yeah, we're going to be looking at a continuous population growth. I think the Windsor area is growing right now. The last few months, anyways, about 1,000 people a month. So, I mean, you know, we're definitely going to be needing the accommodations here. We have the battery plant. There's mm-hmm. a potential for two or possibly even three new additional companies coming in the area to help, you know, feed the battery plant with parts and things like that. We've got the new, there's new developments going on downtown. You know, we're looking at Amazon, we're looking at the hospital. You know, we're definitely looking at a growing community.
And some of those guys, like they're already buying. Like I've got a client that is currently, you know, set to close May 1st. He works at the battery plant. So, you know, it's happening. There's a lot of people that are already starting to move down here, and they're here, you know, typically on a temporary basis. You know, he's worked kind of all over the place. He worked out in Alberta for a bit as well. And they'll kind of go where the work is really needed. And when you get, you know, decent sized contracts for something as involved as what the battery plant's going to be, he's like, yeah, it just makes sense to, you know, buy something. Now, granted, he's in a good situation. He makes good money and that sort of thing. So, but I mean, and I don't think that the government is necessarily going to be, I think we're going to see more of these, you know, incentives kind of coming down. Like they are, they mentioned the 30-year amortization for first-time home buyers, right, which is great, but it only applies to new builds. So again, right, everything's like one step forward, one step back, and it's just, it's tougher. And I think that's really where a lot of the focus needs to come into play, is how can they incentivize buyers, is making it easier for them to get the homes. That's great that they're letting them push it out to 30 years amortization. That's great. But when
affecting 4 to 8%
when you're only focusing it into new build properties, of which all the talk over the last year has been, well, we're not building enough homes. Well, perfect. We're going to incentivize these people to buy this thing that there's not enough of already, that we're already admitting that there isn't enough of already. Like that's the solution. Yeah. And now, and I don't know if you guys saw it, but their announcement for the federal budget, they're increasing the capital gains tax for, I think it's for capital gains beyond 250,000, but they're increasing it from 50% tax rate to basically 66 2/3 or 66, something to that effect. But long and short, capital gains tax, or the tax due on a capital gain, is set to go up.
Right.
They're laying the groundwork. And so it's, and I just wrote a little blog on the 30-year amortization. Nick, what you had mentioned about the new builds with the RSPs being able to access more of those. They're extending the repayment deadline for when you have to start repaying to that RSP. So they're trying. Like, I'll give them credit. They are trying to get things going. We just need a little bit. We need a little bit more traction and a little bit more realistic implementation of it, not just new builds. There's lots of resale houses that people can benefit from having a 30-year amortization for a first-time buyer.
Well, Nick, what is the range? I mean, in the Windsor area or in Ontario, whatever your stats are, what are you looking at for your lowest range home right now, average home? And what is the range for the highest average home?
Are you saying for
sale price?
Sale price?
Yeah.
I mean, you can get into something. I'm not talking about a fire sale where you get, you know, you got studs and they're burned. I'm talking, you know, something where you can move in and just do a little cosmetic touch-ups. You can go as low as, I would say, give or take the $300,000 mark. I just, as an example, I just
put it. They're still available at that bridge.
Yeah, yeah, there is. I mean, there'll be competition. You know, I just, as an example, I put a deal together off market. I represented the buyers in this scenario, but we were able to put a deal together for, I think it was $330,000 or $340,000, something along those lines. And it was nice. I mean, you know, minor touch-ups of paint and whatever, but it was a move-in ready, you know, home. And so, I mean, there are opportunities like that. Obviously, you know, if you can get closer to that 400,000, you just get something that much better. Right. And then so on and so forth. And then obviously the sky's the limit. There's, you know, you got properties up to, you know, millions. Right. So, but somebody can get into something for give or take, call it even 350.
So the average right now is what, sitting around 650 for the average home in Ontario?
Year to date, we're actually at, in Ontario, I don't know, but for Windsor and Essex County, we're at 566. I have the stats opened here on my computer. So 566,000 for year to date until the end of March.
Okay. Okay. And then after
that's average sale price. Yeah.
Yeah.
After the interest rates, you know, drop down a little bit, we'll see where that goes. That's definitely going to be an interesting thing. Now we've talked about a lot. We don't want to take up all your time because I appreciate, I know you're a busy guy. Is there anything that you feel that we've missed that we should have, been talking about? Is there anything on your mind that really kind of says, oh, hey, people should really know this?
Just I think maybe just the conversation of even though new homes might not be quite the answer because new homes are typically more expensive, but my dad actually really harps on the idea of pushing the 40-foot lot again. And I mean, that's something that you don't see anywhere. That might be a great opportunity for the government to really focus on. So if he's represented a very large developer on the east side for many, many years, and at the time they were putting up 40-foot, on front 40-foot frontages, right? Sometimes 50, but and they did great out there because it was affordable at that time for a new build. You were able to get into a new home for, for a little bit less than you would obviously for something larger. So, but I don't see anybody doing that. I don't see anybody really, unless you can find an infill lot, but that's one home that's built, So, now, obviously, there's got to be incentive there for the builders. Is it worth it for the developers? Is it worth it? So that's what we, I think, maybe should shine some light on from the government perspective, maybe to incentivize some of these developments to occur, because that will help pump out an extra, I don't know, X amount of homes per X amount of acres, versus just doing luxury homes, like we've seen in the recent years. So perhaps that's an idea, one of many, but I don't know. That's maybe a topic.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to talk about that because I completely agree with you. I think we're going to be seeing a shift in how we live. We talked about it a little bit on some of the other podcasts about, multi-generational homes, renting out people who are retired, renting out space in their homes to make things more affordable. Smaller the ADUs, and just basically building smaller homes where everybody's so used to building the big luxury homes and wanting all the space and everything else, that I think we're heading back into another direction. So yeah, I'd love to have you back on. I know Sean and I both talked about this topic, and really kind of go into the idea of homes and lifestyles and what we're looking at for the future. I think that'd be a really great topic.
I'd love
Well,
to come
we've
back
already
to
set the groundwork then. We already know we're going to have Nick back again. I love it.
Absolutely.
I love it. We
Absolutely.
get to nerd out with some of the data. So, anyways, Nick, we know you are super busy, so we will let you get back to your day. Thank you very much. Where can everybody find you? You're based out of the Deerbrook office right on Eugenie, correct?
Yep, correct. Our main office is on Eugenie, Deerbrook Realty, fantastic brokerage. And then I run the Team Monty Real Estate Group within that brokerage. So we're either at that office there or, like today, working from home. But my website, teammonty.ca, you can reach us from there. And that's all the information you'll need right there.
Beautiful.
Perfect.
Thank you very much, Nick. Nick Monteleone from Deerbrook Realty at Team Monty. I'm Sean Santoro with TMG, the Mortgage Group, and my co-host, Dave McCall. Everybody, thank you for tuning in. Until next time on the Real Connection podcast.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Nick.